via live broadcast. Sorry we couldn't accommodate everyone that wanted to be here, but we appreciate the enthusiasm. My name is Metta Adams. I'm a graduate student in history here at Sonoma State and have been profoundly influenced and inspired by the man we at Sonoma State have the honor to hear speak this evening. Howard Zinn has altered the perspective towards history and history writing for many, including myself, with his works such as A People's History of the United States, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, and his new book, Marx in Soho. I see Howard Zinn as America's conscience, telling the stories and truths that much of America and the world prefer to suppress. Using his own words, perhaps, tell it best. If history is to be creative, to anticipate a possible future without denying the past, it should, I believe, emphasize new possibilities by disclosing those hidden episodes of the past when, even in brief flashes, people show their ability to resist, to join together, occasionally to win. To believe in democracy is to believe in the principles of the Declaration of Independence. When a government betrays those principles, it is being unpatriotic. A love of democracy would then require opposing your government. It would require being out of order. And finally, to be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. So with those remarkable words in mind, and without further ado, may I present the one and only Howard Zinn.
Thank you. I'm vaguely aware there's an audience out there. You're in the dark, and I guess these lights are coming this way. But I see about three people out there who obviously can applaud very loudly. Well, I'm happy to be here, Sonoma State, where Mario Savio taught. And where his spirit still lives on. I understand that there's been a student strike here for a couple of days, and I think this is a remarkable thing, students and faculty sticking together against the powers, and I understand that as a result of the student strike, the administration has sort of come around, and that there are possibilities for change. So I think you all deserve a lot of credit for what you're doing here. And it's another instance of where when people get together and they organize and they declare themselves and they withhold their bodies from where they're supposed to be, things begin to happen. So I also promised that I would read that I would announce something that's going to happen here on Saturday. There's going to be a Mother's Day call to abolish nuclear weapons, and there's going to be a gathering at the Courthouse Square in downtown Santa Rosa, this coming Saturday at what time is that? At 4 o'clock? Okay. So, can you all hear me?
Yeah.
No problem. Okay. I said I would talk about history and the uses of history. And I went into history, if history is something you go into. I went into history, decided to teach history and write history and study history. And I guess I had a modest aim in doing that. I wanted to change the world. And I thought history would be a good place to start. And I I started out with a point of view. I started out knowing that I would not be a neutral historian. The title of my memoir, "You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train," is something I would say to my students at the beginning of the course, to let them know right from the start that they were not going to be experiencing a neutral teacher. They were not going to have that situation where you spend a semester or a year with a teacher, and at the end of the semester, the end of the year, you have no idea where this teacher stands on what's going on in the world. I didn't want to be that kind of teacher. And my point was that there really is no such thing as neutrality in a world which is already moving in certain directions. As a world where wars are taking place, where children are going hungry, in a world which is already happening, to be neutral in such a world is to collaborate with whatever is going on. And I did not want to be a collaborator. So I knew from the start I would not be neutral. I knew there was no such thing as objective history. Unless objectivity simply means being honest about what you're doing. But if objectivity meant being detached from history, and then I knew there were, that was something that was neither possible nor desirable. Not possible, really, because as soon as you begin to do history, you're confronted with the fact that you are dealing with an enormous amount of data which is available, and you have to select from that enormous amount of data that which you will write about, that which you will present, that which you will teach. And that process of selection is based on what you think is important. Of course, sometimes, too often in our world, it is based on what someone else thinks is important. But in any case, it's based on a kind of notion as to what should be presented. And this is the most important judgment that is made in the teaching of history and in the writing of history, what to omit and what to put in. And the greatest lying that takes place in history is not outright lies about what happened. The greatest lying that takes place by omission. Because if you lie about something, somebody can check up on that lie. But if you leave something out, it's very hard for somebody to find out what it is you left out of the story. And I understood that when I started out teaching, that there was no such thing simply as an unadorned fact. I'm emphasizing this now because you probably know that there's a kind of rage around the country, in the world of education, and around the world of education, in which they are very unhappy with what young people are learning in history. And what they keep saying is that young people don't know the facts. I remember not long ago, Robert Dole, I don't know if you remember him, Robert Dole, when he was running for president, gave a talk to the American Legion, one of his favorite audience, and Dole said, he was lamenting the fact that his students are not learning facts, they're learning interpretations, they're not learning facts. He reminded me of the character in Dickens' novel Hard Times, a character named Gradgrind, if any of you know that novel, Gradgrind is the sort of a caricature of a school teacher, or at least I want to think he's a caricature and not the real thing, you see. But the Gradgrind is says to the younger teacher coming up, he says, you must teach your students only facts. Nothing but facts. But, you know, there's no such thing as just a fact. Once a fact is thrown out into the world, once it is presented, once it is taught, once it is written, it is not simply a fact, but because behind it, there's always a judgment. And the judgment that has been made is that this fact that I'm presenting to you is important to present. And another judgment has been made that other facts, which I am not telling you about, are not important enough for me to tell you about. So I was aware that, and starting out, you know, that what people got in history, what they learned, what was presented to them was presented always from a point of view, and from the point of view of what the presenter thought was important. You know, and so when the New York Times at one point gave an exam or did a survey of what high school students knew about history, you know, they do this every once in a while, to show how dumb students are and how smart are the givers of the survey, you know. And the New York Times asked questions of the students to test their knowledge of history. They asked questions like, you know, who was the president during the War of 1812? Who was the president during the Mexican War? I can see you already thinking. You know, we live in a very quiz-conscious culture. And all you do is throw out a question, no matter how stupid the question is, and people will immediately go to work on it, you see. It really doesn't matter who is president. You know, it doesn't matter that Polk, just to relieve you, that Polk was president during the Mexican War. That's not really the important thing. I mean, here's the New York Times, the summit of American intellectual journalism. As I say that, I feel just a little sick. We'll see. But, I mean, these are the kind of questions that the New York Times is asking, you know. Now, there are important questions they can ask. There are important facts about the war with Mexico, much more important than who was president. You know, the New York Times might have asked the question, how did the war with Mexico start? Ah, that would be interesting. Because it might give you a clue to how wars start in general. Because you would find then, if you looked into the Mexican War, that there was this incident. There's always an incident. An incident which has been planned, actually. Not that that specific incident has been planned, but the war has been planned and waiting for the right incident to come along so that the planned war can take place. Really. Because Polk, sorry to mention his name again, whoever he was, he knew that war with Mexico would be a desirable thing for a very simple reason, that there was all this land that Mexico had in the southwest of the United States that Polk wanted. And so troops were sent into disputed territory, which Mexico thought was theirs, the United States thought was its. The disputed land between the Rio Grande River and the Nueces River, and there was a clash of arms between Mexicans and Americans, and immediately Polk goes to the nation, says, American blood has been shed upon American soil, we must go to war. And we did. And it was one of those short, splendid wars in which the Mexicans are defeated in a short while, and the United States ends up with half of Mexico. Now that would be an interesting question to answer. How did the war start? Because it might lead them to other interesting questions about how other wars start. And then they might take a look at the war in the Philippines, a war which is not very much mentioned or passed over very quickly in our history books, because what occupies the attention at the turn of the century is the Spanish-American War. You know, because, you know, that was a heroic war. That's the war which brought on this description of a splendid little war by an American official. And the Spanish-American War, of course, the war fought for humanitarian reasons, because we're always fighting wars for humanitarian reasons. And we went into Cuba because Spain was oppressing Cuba, and we are always on the side of the oppressed. And so we went in and we expelled Spain and inserted ourselves, you see. We replaced Spain as the power in Cuba, and made sure we wrote into the Cuban Constitution provision that the United States could intervene in Cuban affairs anytime we felt like, and established a military base in Cuba, which has lasted, you know, as you know, for 100 years. But I remember that got attention. That is that war, the Spanish-American War. Which actually should be the Cuban-Spanish-American War, because the Cubans were fighting the Spaniards. They were fighting for their own independence, and if the United States had not intervened, there would have been a defeat for Spain at the hands of the Cubans themselves, who would then have set up an independent Cuban Republic. The United States did not want this, especially since the Cuban rebels were mostly black, and it was said at the time that if we allow the Cubans to win the war against Spain, then we will have another black republic in the Western Hemisphere. Haiti was the first, and now Cuba would be the second. And so the Cubans were pushed aside, and the American army moved in, and then of course, after we win the war, the American corporations move in, the railroads move in, and the banks move in, and United Fruit moves in. And in this way, we liberate Cuba. But then what doesn't get very much attention in history books is what follows, and what follows is the war in the Philippines. And the war in Cuba is a very short war, and an immediate victory. The war in the Philippines is a long, bitter, bloody war, which lasts for years and years, a war which in many ways is a precursor of the war in Vietnam, because it's a war filled with atrocities in which the United States is determined to take over the Philippines, Philippines had belonged to Spain, but there too there's a Filipino independence movement. We cannot allow the Filipino independence movement, right? Filipinos can't run the Philippines, right? You know, they're not civilized in that way. You know, McKinley said this, you know, we have to civilize them and Christianize them and kill them. know which comes first. But massacres occurred in the Philippines before the Philippine Islands were conquered by the United States. And the war in the Philippines starts with an incident. There are American troops, there are Filipino troops, and a Filipino soldier wanders across a line, and the firing starts, and zoom, the war is on. And so that simple question of how did the war in Mexico, the war start in 1846, becomes then a question of how do war start, and how does the Filipino war start, how does World War I start, and so on. And you get to Vietnam and the Gulf of Tonkin, and another manufactured incident which leads to the United States escalation of the longest war in American history in Southeast Asia. So there are facts which are trivial, like who the president was in this year, you know. And there are and then there are facts which are really important. I suppose I came to this view of history as always representing a point of view, and as history representing a set of facts which are given to us and handed down by people who have decided for us what are the important facts, and who have decided for us what are the facts that are not important for them to tell us about. They're not going to tell us about the massacre in 1906 in the Philippines, the massacre of the Moros in one of the southern Philippine islands, of 600 people living, men, women, children, living on this island. And an American army goes in and massacres every one of those 600 people. And then President Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, sends a message of congratulation to the military commander on this splendid military victory. That was not told to me in my history classes, and I don't think it was told in any history classes, because Theodore Roosevelt was always presented as one of the great, on any list of great American presidents. I mean, it's a rather pitiful list, of course. But on any list of great American presidents, Theodore Roosevelt is always near the top, the rough rider, the tough guy, and they leave out the fact that he was a racist and an imperialist and there he is on Mount Rushmore. Hard to remove. I've thought about it. But I came to this peculiar set of views about history, I guess, sort of out of my own background, out of the fact that by the time I came to teach and study history, I'd already sort of been doing a bunch of things and had a number of experiences. I didn't go right from high school to college to study history. I wasn't a freshman in college until I was 27 years old, which should encourage some of you who have spent 10 years at Sonoma State. And it doesn't really matter what age you are, right? But at the age of 18, I didn't go directly to college. I went to work in a shipyard. I was a shipyard worker for 3 years. I didn't do this as a sociological experiment. Go into the shipyard and talk to the shipyard workers and see what they're like. It wasn't that way at all. I came from a working class family where there was no thought of kids going to college. You just, at the age of 18, you finished high school and you went out and you went to work. With that kind of a background, you might say I grew up with a kind of class consciousness. A phrase you don't hear a lot about in American culture, class consciousness. I grew up with an understanding of the fact that there was a world of rich and a world of poor, a world of people who worked very, very hard, like my father did, like my mother did, and didn't have very much to show for it, despite all the stories and the Horatio Alger myth of America, how if you work hard, you will become prosperous and successful. And I knew this wasn't true, because I look at my parents and I could look at all the people I knew around me who worked very, very hard, and no, they weren't prosperous and they hadn't made it in the American sense. And then I looked at people who were very rich, and I couldn't tell what they did. And when I found out what they did sometimes, it was bad and very often dangerous. So I grew up with an understanding that there was no necessary relationship between how hard you worked and how successful you were in the American system, no necessary relationship how intelligent you were and what rewards there were for you in the system, and certainly no relationship between what contribution you made to society and how rich you became. And so you might say, I started off with the idea there was something not quite just about the American economic system, despite all the goodies that it had produced over the years and which it flaunted before the world very proudly. And this class consciousness, I suppose, entered into my teaching. I was aware that when I had gone to these history classes and as an undergraduate in graduate school, I went to graduate school at Columbia University, there were things that I was reading about myself, the things I was interested in, and that never showed up in my textbooks, never showed up in my classes as an undergraduate or in graduate school. I was reading about the history of the labor movement in the United States. I was reading about that very dramatic history of strikes in the period between 1877 and 1914. This country experienced a series of labor struggles which were more dramatic and violent than almost any set of labor struggles anywhere in the world. These did not appear in my classes or in my history books. The academic world didn't recognize them. I saw nothing there about the Ludlow Massacre of 1913-14, about the Colorado coal strike of 1913-14, nothing about the Lawrence Textile strike of 1912. The name of Mother Jones, that remarkable 85-year-old organizer of miners, her name never appeared in any of my classes or any of my books. Mother Jones, who led children on a march from Pennsylvania to President Theodore Roosevelt, who was vacationing on Oyster Bay, and led these children on a march against child labor, carrying signs to show to the president, the signs saying, "We want time to play." And none of this, you know. And instead, the story of American economic progress was presented as one great triumphal story. And I remember sitting there in class enthralled. Oh, look how many steel ingots were produced. Look at how many miles of railroad track were laid after the Civil War, and the Transcontinental Railroad, the Union Pacific, and the Central Pacific meeting romantically in somewhere, you know, president driving a golden spike. Do they still teach that? I can't forget that golden spike. Yeah, and. And it was all a feel-good history, feel-good about the economic miracle of the United States, but nothing about the people who worked on those railroads, nothing about the Irish immigrants and the Chinese immigrants who worked long, long hours on those railroads and died in large numbers in the heat and the cold and sickness and nothing about them. Nothing about the girls who worked in the textile mills of New England and went to work at the age of 12 and died at the age of 25. That was Carnegie, the great entrepreneur and heroic figure. Nothing about the people who worked in Carnegie's steel mills. So I was aware of that as I began to study and to write and to teach history. I was also aware of how the well-being of the nation, the economic well-being of the nation, was always described through the eyes of the upper classes. Because if the upper classes were doing well, it was a time of prosperity. And so there were the gay 90s. Remember the gay 90s? I don't expect you to personally remember. I'm not talking about our 90s. I'm talking about the old 90s. Yeah, but, when one of the most severe economic depressions hit the United States, one third of the population was unemployed, and kids were dying in the cities by the thousands of illness because they were drinking contaminated water, while the rich had purified water, and this was the 1890s, and a time of bitter labor struggles and labor massacres and so on. But it was called the gay 90s, and the 1920s, the age of prosperity, the jazz age, and then I did my doctoral dissertation on Fiorello LaGuardia. And some of you know Fiorello LaGuardia, know him as a mayor of New York. Well, some people know him only as an airport. But, don't we have a recent president after whom they named an airport? And my hope is that he will only be remembered as an airport, you see. But I... I worked on LaGuardia, not as a mayor, but before he was a mayor, in the 1920s, he was a congressman representing a poor district in East Harlem. And I was reading the letters written by his constituents in East Harlem to Fiorello LaGuardia. In the age of prosperity, he was getting these letters from the people living in this neighborhood, and the letters were, "My husband is out of work. My kids don't have enough to eat. They've shut off the gas and electricity. Please, we need some help." And letter after letter after letter like this in the age of prosperity. And then when I looked further, I found that this was not just true in East Harlem. It was true all over the country, that there were people in desperation, people who were hurting, but it didn't matter because the Wall Street was booming. And that's how the age got its name, the jazz age and the age of prosperity. Of course, when you learn that kind of history and you transpose it to the present time and you think about today and you think about how the prosperity today, the economic condition of people in the United States today is measured by the Dow Jones average. There's nothing more certain every night on television than you will hear how the Dow Jones average is doing. And the premise is that if we only know how the Dow Jones average is doing, we know how we are doing. We know that if the Dow Jones average has shot up, our spirits should shoot up, because our lives will be better tomorrow, you see. And, just try telling that to the people who clean the offices or the people who wait on tables or anybody who works or any of that vast number of Americans who do not benefit from the stock market, and tell them, "Don't you know the Dow Jones average has gone up?" You learn, you look at the past, and then you look more